Save big money on your summer project at Menards. Transform your garage with rock-solid floor coatings. Complete your project with a showroom-quality finish in 1 weekend. A one-car kit covers up to 250 square feet. Get everything you need to complete your project with rock-solid floor coatings. Our knowledgeable team is ready to help bring your dreams to life, 1 gallon at a time. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money on your summer project at Menards. Transform your garage with rock-solid floor coatings. Complete your project with a showroom-quality finish in 1 weekend. A one-car kit covers up to 250 square feet. Get everything you need to complete your project with rock-solid floor coatings. Our knowledgeable team is ready to help bring your dreams to life, 1 gallon at a time. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
This is Hidden Tillers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
Lindsay Clancy's murder trial is getting underway in Plymouth. Both sides agree that she took the lives of her three children. The only question is whether postpartum psychosis made her criminally responsible. That is the big question. And today we're going to do a big psychological breakdown of this case. Been very much looking forward to this. We're going to tackle it in three different lanes. We're going to talk first about what is postpartum psychosis, because it is different than postpartum depression. It's different than the baby blues. It's different than just turning a frown upside down. We're going to dive into that because that's the core of this case, and understanding the main core elements is rather important to decipher a case and work through it. Then we're going to talk about Lindsay Clancy herself, the clinical picture. What was going on with her specifically? We're going to dive into all that. And then also, why is it so hard, it seems, for the court system to understand mental health and the community as a whole to fully grasp this? And will a jury of 18 of her peers be able to come to a conclusion at the end of the day and a verdict? That is all in store for you today. We welcome your questions, your comments, all that in the comment section on Substack, YouTube, Facebook, X, wherever you're watching us. Please weigh in. Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author, is who is with us to help us break this whole thing down, along with Robin Dreek, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. Let's start here. 80% of new mothers get some version of baby blues, if you will. That is, I'm going to say broadly, some version of it. 1 in 7 gets categorized into postpartum depression. 1 in 2 per 1,000 get psychosis. People treat those like the same condition if they don't quite understand it, like it's one with a different volume. In our interest of understanding psychosis, postpartum psychosis specifically, is psychosis even part of the spectrum of postpartum depression, or is it a completely different animal, Siobhan?
Absolutely different animal. Absolutely different. And this is one of the things I'm most passionate about, because psychosis runs in my family. Mm-hmm. And I have a very deep awareness and understanding of it, because it's something I've really focused on and studied for my entire career. And even years before I was a therapist as a kid, I was always trying to figure out, why is my aunt so weird, you know? Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's a completely different animal. Baby blues is mainly caused by fatigue. You know how, if you've had a kid, you know how exhausted you are. You're not sleeping. You may be up most of the night. Breastfeeding takes a toll. The hormones are going crazy. And baby blues is completely normal. Now, when you move into postpartum depression, that's a deepening of, you know, it's a different quality to it. And that's when, I mean, most people have had episodes of depression, but this can be a very deep depression. And you want people to get help and support with that, because that may go on for months. You know, that baby blues is a short-term thing when you start getting the kid regulated and you're sleeping and breastfeeding is, you know, kind of been resolved and things are fine. It will self-correct. Postpartum depression, maybe not. They may need some therapy. They may need, you know, temporary, some kind of medication to help regulate their nervous system. But it's definitely something that can improve. Postpartum psychosis is a broken brain, completely different. It's not depression, although you can get depression with it. But psychosis is someone that's had a complete and utter break with reality. They're having delusions, false thoughts that can't be true. They're often having hallucinations, usually auditory hallucinations. And this can be very extreme, although I can talk about it for an hour, but I'll sort of intersperse as we talk here so I don't just give a lecture. Yeah. But one of the key points I want to make, because even people involved in true crime and very educated people don't understand the difference between psychopath and psychotic. And mm-hmm. it's so important to understand mm-hmm. because we talk about these things. We throw these words out all the time. Psychopath is a personality type. It's a predator. It's someone with no conscience. And these are people that commit a lot of crimes. Obviously, you know, a large percentage of the prison population is psychopathic. They're people we want to understand and watch out for. So we talk about those folks a lot in true crime. Psychotic can also be somebody that commits a crime, but the majority of people who are psychotic do not. But that's a brain disease. It's a symptom of something that's underlying, like schizophrenia, bipolar 1 disorder, and then there are a few other things that can cause it, but it's usually one or the other of those. And when you get psychosis postpartum, this is a Category 5 hurricane. This is an emergency because this person is no longer thinking in a rational, cogent way. They're not like the rest of us. And, you know, when you have that person taking care of a newborn and other young children, terrible things can happen. And that's what we're seeing here with this case.
Siobhan, I was looking this up when you said I didn't really realize that because, yeah, there's a huge difference between psychosis and psychopaths, huge difference. And I didn't really realize that it's actually genetic. It can be genetic. Yes. Run in families. And actually, yes. I just looked it up if it does run in her family, and there's no record of that yet. Do you think that's something that they would actually maybe try to look up and try to research to put into account when doing a defense of her? Would it be, have you seen that before? Maybe not.
It sure should be. I don't know that it often is done because, you know, the court system doesn't always seem to be interested in in-depth explanations for psychological processes, unfortunately, but highly heritable, highly genetic. And that's why on my mother's side of the family in particular, if you look, you can trace it down generations from an aunt to my aunt's daughters. Mm-hmm. I've got cousins who have struggled with it. My aunt ended up in a mental institution for, you know, multiple years near the end of her life, but went undiagnosed for most of her life throughout my childhood. Nobody ever diagnosed her. We just said she was weird. Yeah.
Yeah, they're complete blips because everything else, you know, that I do and that we cover a lot of times are these arcs of behavior, and her arc of behavior is not this. And so those psychotic breaks really explain those away.
Yes.
You know, and we've said this before when dealing with psychopaths, no other species of any organism on this planet is sadistic or psychopathic. It's just us as humans. And this seems to be popping up that's very unique to us as a species on this planet as well. Genetically, I mean, I know it's a question that goes into genetics and our evolution and everything. Any idea why we actually have this trait that actually can pop up genetically for us? I mean, it just makes no sense in a way of survival or in procreation or anything why we'd have this trait that popped up.
Yeah, it really seems to be a flaw in humanity. And it's you know, people may speculate when it comes to psychopaths, some people say, well, they're useful, you know, because there are times you need in war, you need somebody who's brutal, who doesn't have a conscience. So evolution may favor psychopathy, you know, in some way. This is still being speculated about, that they have a use. But when it comes to psychosis, that kind of broken brain, I mean, it's sort of like a terrible disease like cancer, you know? It's like diabetes. It's like this flaw in the body, in this case, in the brain and the neurological system, that that absolutely ruins people's lives. It's just an insidious, insidious condition.
To help people understand, a psychopath, basically, personality type, you're born with it. That's who you are. That's what it is.
Yeah.
Psychotic brain disease, it can come on. It can be, yes, be triggered by something and then, yes, and then come on. Can it also, I mean, if you get into that state, I think I know the answer to this, but I want your answer to it, you know, you can come out of it as well, correct? Mm-hmm. And when you come out of it, in obviously this will be conjecture, but when we're looking at Lindsay Clancy here, when she was able to come out of that state, is the person aware of what they did? Are they like, is there memories of those moments? But you know, memory of these thoughts that at that moment in time made sense to her. But when you're out of the psychotic state, clearly you can see the error in your ways, to put it lightly.
Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful question because you see a lot of different patterns with it. And some people, when severely psychotic, don't remember what they did. Mm-hmm. Most people do. You're able to sit and talk with them. And sometimes it does sort of abate naturally. It seems like it was an episode, particularly bipolar 1 disorder, which is the type of bipolar where people do get very psychotic. That can come and go. It can ebb and flow. But most of the time with schizophrenia, the other one, they don't remit without treatment. You know, they really need psychiatric medication that can stop the hallucinations, stop the delusions, and bring them back to their baseline. Because most people, before they have a psychotic break, which can come on suddenly, they're perfectly normal. You would never look at them and think, this person is ultimately going to have a psychotic episode. There's not the warning signs that you see with many of the criminals we talk with, where you look at the behavior patterns over the lifespan and you can go back to, well, they were doing things as kids that were cruel and hurting animals and all that. With psychosis, it can come on most often in early adulthood, sometimes late teens, you start seeing some of the delusional things start, or the hallucinations. But it can come on at any time. It can come on in middle life, even in elderly folks. In elderly folks, another interesting bit is sometimes dementia can come along with psychosis, which is really a nightmare to manage.
What is it that brings it on in, what is it, 2 out of every 1,000, 1 or 2 out of every 1,000 women who go through a pregnancy, it's rare, much more rare than yeah, postpartum depression. But what is it that brings it on through that modality of being pregnant? Is it the hormone changes, yes, the ups and the downs and all that? And yes, then that already stimulate something that the brain already has, just kind of needed the key to be unlocked?
Yeah, a neuroscientist could probably give a more sure, in-depth explanation of what I can. But as I understand it, the tremendous hormonal shifts that happen in pregnancy, if you have a brain that's already sensitive to this kind of change, that the hormonal changes along with the stress of having another child, particularly if you've got several other kids, this can cause this break to happen. Mm-hmm. So it's something we'll be studying for a long time and hopefully getting better at spotting it and monitoring what could be going on.
Yeah, and that's my question, Siobhan. So I was looking up, postpartum psychosis has been recognized for over 2,000 years. I mean, the Greeks had it recognized. I mean, this has been around for a long time. It was included in DSM a number of years ago, obviously. Are we getting better at recognizing this, or are we ignoring it? I mean, it's kind of shocking that, because I was expecting this to actually just be a recent thing that we started recognizing as we've gotten more advanced, as we've, you know, not stigmatized mental health. Maybe this is kind of a new thing, but it's not a new thing. Just look, Google it and you'll see, oh my God, how come we're not doing better at this right now?
We're doing, as an entire society, we are doing a shit poor job of understanding mental health and understanding mental illness in every type of mental illness. I'm online a lot and I'm monitoring the chatter and people are still saying demon possession. A lot of people are saying they're hearing the voices of demons. And it just makes me absolutely crazy because I did hear that in my religious childhood upbringing. Yep. These people are all demon possessed. We've got to pray it away. Guess what? Doesn't work. That's how people get killed. Yeah. So we've got to keep educating, which is why I appreciate you guys and what we try to do on this show so much, because that's what it's about. We can't solve problems when we're ignorant about what causes it and what it looks like. And we've got to try to educate people. But families also, you know, I have had in my 30 plus year, I hate to say how many years because it really dates me, but my 30 plus years of practice, I have had one case of postpartum psychosis, and it terrified me. Because of the woman being home alone with the baby. The family was blowing it off. They were saying she's just stressed. She's always been a little anxious. She's having some anxiety. It was psychosis. And I could see it very clearly. Her OB didn't see it. And the family was leaving her home alone with the baby all day. So
what allowed you to see it? And other people were going along the life arc that she gave, you know, cause this, you know, Lindsay's a great example of this. When you first do that deep dive, her background, who she was, the type of wife, the type of mother, the type of daughter, the type of nurse, it gives that arc of nothing to worry about here. But what allowed you to see it in that other case that the others weren't? Because I'm guessing it's probably very similar in a lot of that respect.
She came in crisis, and she was a former client that I hadn't seen since her pregnancy. And I got a crisis call from her, and I was able
to... And I'm sorry, Siobhan, let me interrupt. What's a crisis call to you?
When somebody calls really agitated, and I hear in their voice, we've got to change here. You know, we've got something different. And she was very upset. She wanted to come in and talk to me. And... as they say, I'm really tuned into psychosis, and not all therapists are. So I think even, you know, people who are fairly good therapists, it's just not their area of interest, so they don't study it. I think therapists miss it a lot of the time, which is a tragedy. They've got to do better. You know, we've got to hold them accountable for paying more attention. But in talking with her for an hour, I knew what questions to ask and how to really get into, okay, what's the thinking processing going on here, which the family wasn't really doing that. And they were just saying, oh, she's always been anxious, you know, so she's just having anxiety. And then going on with their day, because they also had an investment in not wanting her to be their term crazy. They didn't want her to be crazy. Very proud family, very educated people. And they were above that sort of thing. So I ended up, I was so alarmed. She was at home alone with the baby. She didn't feel safe at home alone with the baby. She was telling people that they weren't listening to her. So I called her husband, got her consent, and she agreed, called her husband from work and said, you need to come into my office. I canceled the following person because, you know, sometimes you have to do that and say, I have to reschedule you because there's a crisis. I called both her parents to come in and her sister to come in. And I tried to get through to them, this is not okay. She needs to be in a hospital. And then it was quite an ordeal because we lived in a community in California that did not have a private psychiatric hospital. And even though she was well insured, you call around to try to find a psychiatrist to see somebody in case of emergency. New clients, a wait of 6 months. Right? Or, and this is the norm in the country. This is a standard throughout America. You know, I wrote a number down, 40% of people in the U.S. live in a federally designated mental health shortage area where there just aren't people. We have a terrible shortage of psychiatrists. And this is the kind of thing, we shouldn't put this on the obstetrician to manage, you know, or the...
And one of the things in this case, I mean, the mental health desert, what, you know, and I will say this, thank God this exists. I mean, the fact that we now have online therapy, that does certainly help some of the mental health deserts that used to exist. But still physically, they do exist, but it I guess it's better than nothing. And we've had, you know, those supporters over the years. Lindsay's providers allegedly charted intrusive thoughts when she described a male voice commanding her to hurt her children. Is that an intrusive thought or something else completely different that should have been handled and looked at for the weight that it was?
Completely different, completely different. And that's a clinical failure. Were they not listening well enough? Were they not asking the right questions? Was it a 15-minute check-in visit? You know, what was going on? Because intrusive thoughts, a lot of us have had some intrusive thoughts. It can go with major depression, you know, and that's along the lines of, I just screw everything up all the time. I'm a loser. I can't get a good job. You know, they're unpleasant. You recognize them as, this is a thought I'd rather not be having. But it can also go along. So major depression can cause it. OCD can cause it. I'm really worried about insects in my food. Oh, no, I have to look carefully. Well, right now I have to wash my lettuce really carefully because there could be something in my lettuce. And so they think about it too much. But it's not severe in the same sense of I am literally hearing voices in my head that are telling me things that are completely bizarre and can't be true. And the thing with the psychotic symptoms, the delusional thinking, the person doesn't realize that this is unreasonable. You know, they fully, completely believe it.
Siobhan, the other thing that you keep referring to, asking the right questions, you ask the right questions, you think, I don't want to throw conjecture on it, you know, but you're wondering what questions her therapist asked. Are there specific questions for people that are going through this now or fearful of this now? Is there anything that the type of question you can ask that might be a bit of a wobble that might say, all right, we need to pay closer attention to this, or is it really situational?
It is situational, but I think the key thing is you have to spend enough time with the person to get their internal experience. And, you know, they may not be disclosing of it. So they have to trust you enough to disclose it. So it's really spending that quality time, gaining their trust, and then really asking the things. If they say, well, I'm just feeling upset, I'm not sleeping. Okay, you have to go beyond that. Tell me what goes on in your head when you're not able to sleep. Or they may say, I'm having anxiety. Tell me the thoughts that are behind the anxiety. And so it really takes, let's just go deeper. Let's go deeper. Yeah. Let's go deeper. Right. And sometimes family members, they don't know how to do that. You know, so it takes some presence and skill to be able to go deeper.
Well, and it seems sometimes clinicians don't either. And we're gonna get into that here in just a second. Yeah. That's what postpartum psychosis is as a condition. Now, let's talk about what actually was happening to Lindsay Clancy. And as we do, put your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to continue to weigh in. Lindsay Clancy, that's the case we are talking about today, because she did everything the system tells a struggling mother to do when they're feeling that something is off, very off. She didn't just sit there and go, this is me, deal with it. She went to ERs. She called crisis lines. She checked herself into hospitals who checked her out, took every pill they handed her, and the system kept handing her more and then handed her back. And now she's on trial for taking the lives of her three children after going through that horrific ordeal. We welcome your thoughts in the comment section. Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author, is with us, along with Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent. 13 medications in 4 months. That's the big thing that stands out to me on this whole damn case and just kind of ends it all. Benzos, antidepressants, antipsychotic, a sedative. Her husband told the doctors she was turning into a zombie. At 13 drugs, whether you just had a baby or not, and you're getting on all these different medications this frequently, and one doctor's not talking to the next and communicating what one is on, what may interact this way with that one. Is anyone still actually treating the patient, or are they just kind of handing out TikToks at the behest of big pharma? I mean, what exactly is going on here when you have a situation exactly like Lindsay Clancy's?
Yeah, this is a systemic failure, and I hesitate to lay blame, although I might. I would love in this case to look over all the treatment notes and all the rationales, because when they change a medication, they're supposed to have a rationale for why. Did they in this case? And if they didn't, then that's a flag of a bad doctor. But, you know, I wonder how much time were they spending? Were these 15-minute appointments? I mean, the problem, one of the problems here with the system is insurance doesn't cover hour-long visits for psychiatry. It's supposed to be a quick med check, you know, so they start a med. Were they following up? You know, when you start a med with somebody who's this ill, you want to follow up in a few days, at most a week. You don't want to say, I'll see you next month. And there's no excuse for lacking the coordination of care. Providers need to talk to anyone else who's treating that person. Because, yeah, we really, at this point, it sounds horrible. It's confusing. It obviously, this was not effective treatment.
Yeah.
And it really needs to be, you know, the deconstruction of this whole thing. And who was not paying close attention.
And it sounds pretty par for the course in how we handle prescribing most of these medications in our country. I mean, psychiatrists should be the ones that are prescribing it, but you have so many general cares that just do, because somebody comes in and says, I'm feeling down. Well, let's see what we got in the sample cabinet over here today for you. 17-minute appointments. I mean, if anyone, our audience out there who's takes any of these things, it may have been in those situations where it's like, wow, that was a really quick exam to give me drugs that can dramatically alter my thinking. That's always been disturbing to me, but it is unfortunately the norm, which I'm going to guess you would agree needs to change. Each one of those short psychiatric appointments ended with a new prescription, and it wasn't all psychiatrists that were handing out the Tic Tacs. Nobody stopped to ask whether the first 12 had done anything except make her worse. Is that a failure of the doctor? Is that what basically 17-minute appointments are designed to produce?
Yeah, I have known a handful of wonderful psychiatrists. So there are some that really follow up closely. They coordinate care. If the person has a psychotherapist who they're doing talk therapy with, they talk with that person. They really try to clarify diagnosis. So I don't want to say it's all of them.
No, not at all.
But in a lot of cases, there's a tremendous pressure for them to see a lot of people because of the doctor shortage. Mm-hmm. And so it's almost like people are being churned and you know, pushed through the system, and there's not the time for the follow-up care. And, you know, is the doctor working in a hospital setting or a group which is demanding that they practice that way? I don't think most doctors are well-meaning, but there's this pressure in the system to churn people through.
Yeah, and I want to get to the system here, because while we're discussing this, I'm like, all right, so we're talking about mental health and we're talking about psychiatrists and we're going glass half full, great psychiatrists out there. But if they're limited because of the amount of time they can spend there, what's causing it? And so I did look up in general how our insurance system is covering psychiatry. So no, it's not. So here's the bottom line. So the co-pays, you generally pay the specialist. So they regard psychiatrists not as primary care. They regard them as specialists. So you need a specialist referral. They have co-pays are higher. Deductibles and co-insurance are higher. Most of them are out of network, and so your insurance is not going to cover it all anyway. Prior authorization is required. The visits are limited in the numbers you get. And network adequacy, medication management, and therapy is reduced. And so all these hindrances to want to get good mental health is a big problem in this entire thing.
Yeah. Yeah, you nailed it. Very, very true. And the other thing that I think is a good standard of care is the psychiatrist, particularly someone with postpartum psychosis with an infant, they need to be talking to family members as well. And of course, you have to have a release to do that. But whenever I have somebody that I think is very unstable, or I'm worried about, you know, something bad could happen here, I get a release to talk to family members, because they are spending spending, hopefully, a lot of time with that person, and they may be noticing odd behaviors that that person is not disclosing. Yeah. And so that's something that I think is rarely done. But again, the time, you know, but it's a collateral visit. Sometimes you can just have a phone call with the mother or the father or the husband and say, hey, you know, I'm a little concerned about this and that. What are you noticing at home? It's another important thing.
I want to talk about her husband recognizing the problems here, because he was on her side helping her get to appointments, you know, monitoring this, telling doctors this isn't working. That, I mean, he was very involved. And there's some people who've kind of gone down a road of like, well, he shouldn't have gone on for takeout. Okay, well, I'm sure he looks back on that and goes, bad choice.
Same thing.
But it's not like he wasn't giving a shit. Yeah. He was there. He still is there for her. An interesting element to this case is that allegedly in a previous pregnancy, she had postpartum depression, not postpartum psychosis, at least wasn't diagnosed as postpartum psychosis. So there is a bit of a history here. And if you've gone through that once, if you're the partner of the person who's gone through it, or even if you're the person, if you're her, and you're feeling somewhat similar in certain ways, but different nonetheless, to the partner, that may be presenting as, okay, she's going through postpartum depression again. Okay, we got this. We did it before. It's difficult. It's shitty. I feel horrible for her, but we got this.
Yeah.
As the partner of someone, it would be very easy, in my summation, to not be able to distinguish the two. Number one, he's not a medical provider. Yeah. He's the husband. All of these doctors couldn't quite seem to figure it out. And I wouldn't expect him to either. But how easy is that for someone in a situation like this with multiple children who've had difficulty in the past with postpartum depression to just think, oh, it's that again?
Yeah, very, very easy. Very easy. And I think families do that all the time. They don't have the training to recognize it. And I'm guessing from everything we've heard that he had no idea that she would ever hurt the children. That just is so unfathomable, you know, that it just didn't cross his mind that was a possibility.
Siobhan, another thing that it popped up in a little bit in this case earlier, and then the example you gave, where a lot of times it sounds like, again, we just have a limited data set here, that there's a lot of self-awareness that this person knows that they're having a problem, they're having an issue, they actually reach out to people. Is it more or less common for a level of self-awareness to have someone like Lindsay know that they're having an issue and go seek help on their own, or do they try to hide it more often than not?
I think that's an excellent point because, you know, with her medical background and knowledge, she probably had more insight than most psychotic people do. And sometimes, you know, they try to minimize it. They try to hide it. They find it confusing, shameful, hard to figure out. And so they just try to keep plugging away. And as the symptoms intensify, other people may or may not notice it. And somebody may reach out to get help for them, even when they don't understand what it is, you know, but that's the important
thing.
And
it's easy to dismiss it. We kind of talked about it a little bit already too, just because when you're a healthy person in general, you're surrounded by good, healthy relationships, people figure you got it. And then also, you know, my daughter being a nurse, as I brought up multiple times, believe it or not, they don't have the best health coverage. You know, they're in the same marketplace competing with everyone else. And a lot of times they don't have the best health coverage. And so you have people that are surrounding you saying, we got this, we're loving, good, caring family, and we're only allowed 15-minute visits, and we're out of copays, and you know, so it makes it easy to rationalize away. So I'm not saying he did, it's just the system, like we keep saying, was not structured to take care of people in distress.
Not at all. I'd like you to explain, Siobhan, to people who have the question here, where they cite, which the prosecution is saying, she was coherent the day that this all went down. Pediatrician visit, allegedly played in the snow, ordered takeout. See, she's with it. Explain to people who don't quite understand how someone can be in a full could have a full psychotic break and mm-hmm. still be presenting completely normal to mm-hmm. To people around them on that very same day.
Yeah. Yeah. Great question. And the interesting thing is, if they knew what was going on internally for her, they would have got it. But she was not necessarily disclosing that to them, not mm-hmm. disclosing much about it. And that's common for people with psychosis to present fairly normally. They can get up in the morning, they can shower, they can make food. You know, they may seem that they're doing their normal routine, but it's what's going on in their head that's different. And the family may be picking up on small things that are different, but as you say, just kind of minimizing it. Oh, she's depressed again or whatever. But it's very possible for people to have some degree of strategic planning to know what they're doing. I mean, so many cases come to mind, but the guy who shot Gabby Giffords, I mean, he was going to college. You know, people thought he was weird. He was doing weird things, but he was functional in many ways and yet completely delusional about, you know, that she was doing things to him or whatever. But he wasn't telling people about all the delusions. Mm-hmm. And so he navigated well. He was even stopped on the way to because he did kill people. He was stopped on the way to the murders by a police officer. The cop interviewed him. He said he was very polite. He shook hands with him and had no idea that there were guns in the trunk, you know. So
to that, Siobhan, because again, I think it's important for people to really understand what this looks like to the layperson kind of crossing their path in these things. And correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm kind of taking a wild ass guess at this. As you've described psychosis, is it basically like this, as it presents, is like this person is completely living their normal reactions, they're living their normal life. The psychosis part is like added in. In other words, they don't change who they are, they don't change all the behaviors. They just have this added thing because the psychotic event is being added to them, which is unrecognizable potentially to others because they're presenting in normal because it is normal to them. They just have this added thing that just popped in their head, like voices, images, whatever it is. Is that correct?
It can be. And the other thing that I think is poorly understood is that psychotic symptoms can be on a continuum. And you can have people who are a little bit psychotic. I've got, disclose, I don't think she watches this show, a cousin who...
We'll call her a cousin.
Yeah. She believes that dead people talk to her.
Oh.
And yes.
Seems rational.
And,
they have whole TV channels around that.
Yeah. And she does channel. She does channeling. Okay. And, you know, tries to talk about being a medium. But it's caused a lot. It caused her marriage to end. It's caused lots of problems for her in her life. And if you spend time talking to her, she's very mentally ill. I mean, I picked it up right away.
Yeah.
She's in college right now. She's doing well. She's doing internships out in the community. She's just not talking about the dead people talking to her. Now, that's on one end of the continuum, somebody that can function pretty well. On the other end, and all gradations in between, but on the other end, I have gone out with Mobile Crisis to evaluate people who were literally so psychotic. One guy was sitting on the couch and could not get up to find the kitchen to feed himself. His thinking was so disorganized. The voices were going constantly. Anybody would look at him and go, psychotic. But it's, you know, it's different in different people.
So I'm also curious because I've seen, you know, the pseudoscience shows that cover this kind of thing. And I'm curious. So when people are having one of those moments where let's use, for example, your person we're calling a cousin.
Yeah.
She's at the moment, she is thinking she's channeling someone who's passed and deceased, which is a psychotic moment. Is something different going on in the brain at that time that is recordable, that's actually recognizable?
That would be fascinating to know. And my guess is very likely so, but I don't think we have enough, you know, sophisticated neuroscience monitoring and screening to be able to know that.
They've done it on Long Island Medium. I saw that one episode once where they actually wired her brain up to see what was going on during her events. And that, I was curious whether that was a one-off or whether there's actually been any studies on psychotic events.
Yeah. I do think it has been to a certain degree. I do think so. But yeah, it's at times when they have studied at times when the voices are happening, the auditory parts of the brain are actually lighting up. They are hearing that. And yes, with the more subtle kinds of delusional things where, I'm hearing, you know, my dead grandma talking to me or whatever. Would that, or, you know, and some of hers is just delusional. She's not always hearing the voices, but she's having the thoughts and she's believing that the dead people are communicating.
See, Tony, little did you know you're getting content for Ghost Stories as well.
That's true.
I was thinking about that.
I hear you. I mean, and that's a whole other conversation over there.
Deep conversation.
Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, with true crime and the ghost stories used to be spooky when I do those. Now it's just like, oh, this is such a nice relief from
worlds colliding,
release
Tony.
from the real monsters of the world, the humans. Let's talk about the five providers across multiple facilities. There's a civil lawsuit that the family filed that she and her husband filed against them. None of them pulled a complete history or talked to each other. I think the process or the thought process for most Americans is that if I'm getting a prescription from my doctor, they have a magical system that communicates with the previous doctors and they know what I'm on, or I've told them what I'm on, and they're gonna do their due diligence and make sure that because they're the last line of defense here, other than the patient themselves, of making sure I'm not taking something that's going to be dangerous for me. None of that occurred. Why is that? Is this system not designed for this, not required to do these sort of things? It's just kind of on an honor basis. What failed here so catastrophically, or is it working as designed?
No. Our ethical standard of care, and in order to get a license, a clinical license, it is mandatory that you understand if there are other providers treating the person, including a family practitioner, you are supposed to be communicating with the other providers. If they have a talk therapist, the psychiatrist is supposed to coordinate care with that person to find out what they're seeing. Certainly providers providing different meds are supposed to be communicating with each other. In most cases, that's discouraged. It's like, get one good provider and stick with that person. You know, don't hop around. But I find it a matter of most likely a fatigue on the part of the providers, the overwhelm, the fact that they're just not following standard of care because they don't have the time and energy to do it, which is
Are there any consequences for not, other than getting sued?
Getting sued, and certainly reports to licensing boards can be made, and you can get dinged that way. Now, is the licensing board going to take action in every case? You know, certainly if there's a bad outcome like this, I would think that they would at least be reprimanded.
Yeah, that's why I just looked up standard of care, HIPAA, liability risk, and professional guidelines all require them to communicate like that.
Yes.
It's one of these cases where hopefully this is a cautionary tale for some offices, and that this, you know, indirectly we'll never necessarily know about it, but enough will go, shit. Let's really watch this.
Definitely.
Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube on that portion of our conversation as we continue talking about the Lindsay Clancy case. As we continue to break down the public understanding of the Lindsay Clancy trial, what's going on in it, what was going on in her mind, what was going on in the family and the provider and all of this, the cornucopia that made the Lindsay Clancy case what it is today. Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author, is with us to talk about it, along with Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent. The facts in this case are not in dispute. Lindsay Clancy did take the lives of her three children. She admits it. Her defense admits it. Her husband admits it. The question is whether she's a murderer murderer or a casualty, and almost nobody watching this can sit long enough to consider that both might be true. Actually, a lot of you can. A lot of you are very good critical thinkers, and thank God you are here. The purpose of us talking about this is to help enlighten others on this topic. The prosecution says Lindsay sent Patrick out and then checked the map on her phone to see how long he'd be gone on the, you know, the GPS tracking. And they're saying, and this is where the prosecution really hangs their hat, premeditation. Yeah. She looked up how long he was gone. That means it was premeditated. That means she's a monster. That means she's decided to do these horrible things to her children and then jump out a window. Never mind the 13 medications that she was just jacked around on for the last however many months, and every doctor not taking her seriously. The suicide prevention hotline saying, sorry, you're not serious enough for us. Never mind all of that. It's just, you check GPS, you must be this maniacal, horrible human being. The defense says she checked because she was terrified to be alone. Same fact, opposite conclusions. Why is it that people sit with a, or can't sit with the possibility that both readings might be partially right here?
Mm-hmm. I think people like easy stories.
Yeah.
And sometimes when there's been a horrendous case like this, it's emotionally satisfying to look for who do we blame, you know, who's the monster. And people, I think, can sometimes misread it just because they don't understand it. And certainly this was a monstrous thing that happened, but it doesn't fit with who this woman was, you know, a compassionate person, a loving mother, a labor and delivery nurse. She helped people. This was her goal in life. So it just does not fit that this was coming from a rational place, you know, and even if she did do this in a way that, well, I have time now because he's not going to be here, it was driven by these command hallucinations. And so, yes, all of that can be true.
Yeah, and besides, you keep saying, you know, we want someone easy to blame. And we keep pointing out here, the easiest thing to blame, and I know we don't like doing it, is the friggin' system. The healthcare system for mental health is failing. Again, we keep coming across in so many things.
I mean, is that why we see so much? I mean, I don't know. To me on this case, but we're fairly enlightened on mental health in our circle here. Is it because people just really don't get it? And it's much easier to go and say, she's just a bad person and come up with really simple explanations for this, because facing the reality that of how broken our system is, that's an overwhelming thought. Mm-hmm. And if you're not dealing with the system or never have had to deal with the system, you probably don't necessarily care all that much unless it actually affects you. So this is somebody else's problem. They're all complaining about, until then you're like, you get into it and you're like, oh, this is a monstrous, horrific system that doesn't function very well. Mm-hmm. So if you can tell yourself, not a problem, it's this over here, not a problem, this should have happened. I mean, it's the simplicity of not facing something that's broken and dealing with it. Is that really why it seems it seems so easy for people to jump in this room that she's this monster? I mean, her own damn husband who lost all of his children is standing behind her. Mm-hmm. Why is Karen in Kentucky's voice? Why does Karen in Kentucky think her opinion is so much more valuable than those who actually were there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, people like having a villain. They like an easy narrative. It's emotionally satisfying to them to just be able to say, you know, hang her high because she's a monster.
Yeah.
And that seems to be unfortunately common because people just don't understand the full picture and don't want to put, as you say, they don't want to put the emotional energy into understanding the brokenness of all this. And the other thing that might be happening for some is it's almost a defense mechanism that, well, this is a bad person rather than this is a person with a broken brain. Because if it's a person with a broken brain, maybe all of us could be in that situation. You know, if not when we're young, when we get dementia, we may have a broken brain. And that's a scary thought. So it's easier to create a monster than to acknowledge that.
And we can create monsters, you know, so you want to just kind of flip it around because people don't want to call the system the monster in this. Yet Luigi Mangione called the system United Healthcare the monster, assassinated a guy, and now he's the hero because he had some sort of mental derangement going on because he decided to kill someone because he thought he's being some social justice warrior. So you can demonize a system on that side and stand behind that guy, but on this side is actually legitimately the system failed someone who was seeking help. Yes, according to public record, she sought out help for severe anxiety, insomnia, depression, suicidal ideation, and months leading up to January 23rd. She was so self-aware of all the problems she's having, and the system failed her with 13 yeah. medications, with no doctors collaborating on this. Yet, they want to demonize her, not saying she's not culpable for the three lives that are gone, but at the same time, though, that's a system issue.
Very much. Very yeah. much.
And it's a society that doesn't want to seemingly square up the citizens that are in it, and that not everybody is the person that's looking at it. So everybody looks at I wouldn't do that, or I had a baby, or my sister had a baby, or somebody had a baby, and they didn't go through it. It was just mm-hmm. that, turn that frown upside down.
Right.
Is the type of thinking, and it's just like... Bless your heart. I don't use Southern colloquialisms much because I'm not from the South, but I hear it a lot. Bless your heart. Bless your heart that you live in a world and you have had an existence thus far where you haven't come face to face with the healthcare system or any sort of these crises that allow you to be this viscerally ignorant of other people's struggles. Bless mm-hmm. your heart.
And until one of the comments that this is potentially setting a bad precedent, no, it's not. Because for 4 years, Tony and I have covered cases with a lot of really broken brain people, whether it's Lori Dale Belvallo, whether it's yeah. it's the psychotic mother that wrote this stupid book about killing her husband. All these people, not one other case have we ever said that this was an excuse, except right. this one. Right. Because all yeah. those other people had patterns of nutter behavior. Yeah. This one does not have a pattern of nutter behavior. This was a self-aware person that actually was victimized as much as she's she victimized others by the death of her children. Again, it's no one wins in this one, but no, this is not setting a precedent whatsoever.
Yeah, and the other point, which is very relevant, is that do people fake psychosis after committing a crime? All the time, people can fake psychosis. Forensic yeah. interviewers know, and I won't say how we know how to spot someone who's faking. There's a diagnosis for it. It's called malingering, right? Mm-hmm. And that's a pretty easy thing to suss out when somebody is yes. saying, oh yeah, well, I had to, you know, kill so-and-so because I was hearing voices telling me to do it. Okay, that's not going to be an excuse that flies, you know, no. because we know how to tell who's faking and who's
not. And look at the amount of deep diving they're having to do on this. This isn't just a brush, you know, and right. even with the Nick Reiner case, you know, they are struggling to even see in that complete broken brain whether he's actually going to reach the bar of this. Mm-hmm. And so the level that you have to go through medically to like you said, Siobhan, to suss out whether this is legitimately going to fall in that category or not, the bar is so high. So it's not become a precedent. Actually, it's the opposite. The precedent has been become there is no mental health issue. That's right. actually been more the precedent these right. days.
Where do you think this is going to land with a jury, Siobhan? The judge told the defense that they can't. There's going to be expert witnesses. They wanted to bring in up to like 15 different mothers who've also survived and gone through postpartum psychosis to give the jury some context of what it's actually like from their own perspective, not just kind of the textbook version from the expert witnesses. Judge said, nope, we're not going to hear. That can be a legal argument. We talked about that with Bob, and I do kind of understand why the judge said that from a legal perspective, but damn, that would have been powerful. But without that, with the story being presented as it is, it's seemingly as divisive as this is, as two different groups of society look at this, whether they've been affected by anything in this world, they seem to have a more grounding understanding of this with empathy. People who've never had any touch in this world seem to be very distant from it unless they've educated themselves on it. If you're getting a jury, your peers are probably going to get a pretty solid mix of folks. Mm-hmm. And to get... either side to go either direction, I think, is going to be a stiff challenge, especially with 18 jurors. Do you think we actually get a verdict here other than a hung jury once this is all said and done?
Oh, my God. I sure hope so. I sure hope so that there are good people on the jury who are capable of understanding this. Hope so. And it would be wonderful if they had even allowed a half a dozen women, even three women who have experienced, you know, postpartum psychosis to testify what was this really like for them, just to give the jury more context. I think that would be so powerful. And it may legally not be something that can happen, but I think ethically and morally it should happen.
How do you do that, though? Because, look, I mean, when we talk about this, you get folks, like I said, that seem to understand it or at least be open to it and hearing it. And the ones that don't are just... They're the same type that can easily just walk away from facts and go, I don't believe it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, what do you do with that? What do you do with the crowd that's like, I don't believe it. I didn't happen to me. I don't believe it. Because there's a lot of that. I mean,
there is a lot of that.
Is there any changing that? Is there any educating that? You know, or is it just like, this is why if I were to put money on it right now, I would go with hung jury. And we haven't even heard opening statements yet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's horrible. It's horrible. It all depends on who you get on the jury. And I'm sure her defense is going to do everything that they're allowed to do. And I mean, there's so much scientific, you know, because behavioral science is a science. There's so much science that can be presented about how this is a real thing and how it works and how it affects people. And it's just tragic if she
It's tragic, and hopefully this tragedy can lead us to more education. I think this trial is going to be very educational for a lot of people because, you know, to your point as well, unless you have context, anything in life is hard to understand without context. Unless you have a personal rep yourself or someone close to you with something that is so tragic and so out of the norm, because this is a major behavior norm. People don't do this every day. And one or two in 2,000 even have this potential to have it pop up. It is so far out of the norm that having more people have context, bringing the awareness, hopefully the healthcare industry is watching it when they're talking about how they're going to have coverage and everything too. Because I think there's a lot of things that are on trial here that are being brought to light.
Yeah. And you know, I've heard the word justice thrown around. Where's the justice for the kids?
Yeah.
If we want to look at what would justice be in this case, it's, can we come out of this learning some lessons about improving postpartum care, recognize psychosis, and require that when people are seeking help, that they get help and get decent treatment?
What a thought. You mean justice isn't locking up away a woman who was, you know, bruised and battered by the system and then blamed for it, drugging her 50 ways to Tuesday and then having a horrible outcome? That's not justice. Throwing away the key on that.
Yeah.
You mean something helpful, something productive? Wow. What a concept.
Yeah.
1,000% correct.
And she's incarcerated anyway, whether she's in a psych ward or in the jail system, either way, she's paralyzed from the waist down, and she's in the system. It's not like she's walking free. I can't imagine that there's any situation that's going to come up that's going to have her walk free. Anyway.
I don't see the vitriol in this, and I don't understand why this is. I mean, she's already said lock me away in a mental health facility. That's what I want.
I mean, either cool.
Yeah,
the argument is this. Do you want her locked away in a regular prison system with population, or do you want her locked away where she's going to get mental help? It's really the only thing that's going on trial at the core of what the result at the end of the day is, because at the end of the day, you still have three little babies that were gone, a family that's missing them, a husband that's been devastated, and she's saying, I did it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You can't fix stupid, though. I think that's the other lesson here at the end of the day when it comes to understanding a case like this.
But hopefully we can fix stupid. We're trying to fix stupid.
We're
the
trying
system's
to fix
stupid.
It, but sometimes you just can't. But hopefully you pick something up out of this and went, oh, okay, I'm going to think about that a little bit differently. If we did that, good. Good. Give us your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Love for you to weigh in and give us your thoughts. Siobhan's latest book, Nightbird, available wherever you get books. Go check it out. Audiobook also available. Highly, highly recommended. Robin's latest, It's Not All About Me. It's available also wherever you get books and on Amazon and audiobook. Leave a review there. Also, greatly appreciated. Thank All right, that's going to wrap it up. Be sure to press subscribe and give us your thoughts. Until next time, for Siobhan, for Robin, for Todd, I'm Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Save big money on your summer project at Menards. Transform your garage with rock-solid floor coatings. Complete your project with a showroom-quality finish in 1 weekend. A one-car kit covers up to 250 square feet. Get everything you need to complete your project with rock-solid floor coatings. Our knowledgeable team is ready to help bring your dreams to life, 1 gallon at a time. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save.